Well, hello and a very warm welcome to CBI at 10. I'm Liz Mosley. I'm an editor at Tortoise and I'm here to moderate the session today, a little bit different from where we've been over the past few weeks, but something that has very much been on everybody's mind. And we're joined by a great panel of experts who can really help us get some proper practical actions together. You sit and watch the news, or in my case, you work in a newsroom, and it's easy to feel totally despairing and powerless. You think, what can I do to help? And it's not always immediately obvious what you can do to help Ukrainian people fleeing their homeland. But we're here today to try and work through the considerations if you decide as an owner of a business that you want to be able to offer employment to people who are coming into this country and who are looking for a job, and other things that you might be able to do as well as that. Matthew, lovely to see you. Thank you for being here. Just set the scene a little bit for today's conversation to get us going so we know what we're talking about.
Terrific. Well, thanks, Liz, and hi, everyone. I mean, look, the first thing I just wanted to say is there are just obviously many, many implications from the Russian invasion in Ukraine from a business point of view. Firms will have been hit by economic and financial sanctions in many respects, and they'll be dealing with that. Plenty more will have had disruption and dislocation to their supply chains. Mm-hmm. Firms are scrambling to sort of pause, close, or exit activities in Russia for many reasons. And of course, plenty are dealing with the sort of heightened risk of cybersecurity. So first thing, Liz, I just wanted to say is that we're highly attentive to all of those challenges and plenty more besides. And just to give people a flavor of some of those, look, the sanctions, you know, many firms are going above and beyond those to comply with the requirements. Others are finding it a little bit more challenging for legal obligations. Actually a moral sort of obligation to do the right thing by their people on the ground in many respects. And then on the sort of broader sanctions piece, we've got examples of engineering lead times doubling, probably sort of nudging towards a year, costs of everything ranging from wheat to fertilizer to steel sort of going up by anything in the order of 50 to 100% sort of thing. So there's quite significant economic ramifications. And I just wanted to say we've got plenty of support available on all of that, ranging from other webinars and podcasts that we've done in association with HM Government. We've got sort of supply chain dashboards available for people who want to get a handle on all of that stuff. So we're really, really across it. But then just, Liz, in equal measure, I've been struck by, in so many of the conversations I've been involved in, firms say, look, there's all these challenges on the one hand, but almost in the same breath, they're stepping up and saying, how can I help as well? And there are plenty of ways in which that is possible, including through Office of Employment, but many others that we'll get into today as well. I think there's anything ranging from just financial donations. Plenty of firms I've spoken to have talked about sort of salary matching if their employees want to step up and make donations. There's donations from food to clothing, medical supplies, help with logistics and packaging. And people might have noticed we've been big players and big part of the sort of Food for Ukraine project, working with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, with DEFRA, great support from Accenture and others to really mobilize that. And that's been widely picked up and supported by Mailforce, the Daily Mail's charitable arm as well. So we're getting over a million meals to date, 1.3 million meals headed to Ukraine, another 500,000 or so funded and on the way. So there's terrific efforts there. And I think for Ukrainian nationals arriving into the UK, lots of firms want to help. They've got plenty of goodwill and good intent, but I suspect many are grappling with where on earth do I start? How do I go through the process? And is this really right for me? So those are the kind of the questions, Liz, I think that we're keen to get stuck into over the course of the conversation.
Indeed, Matthew, and thanks very much for that setup. I'm inclined to come straight to Audrey, if I may. Audrey Elliott, sure. Just tell us a bit about your job under normal circumstances, Audrey. Just what do you do?
So I'm an employment and immigration partner at Evershed Sutherland. And my job is to help employers in recruiting people, in getting all the immigration permissions in the right space, and dealing with everything from beginning to end in terms of the employment relationship.
You've been a woman in demand, I'm sure, over the last few years. Now, let's just talk about terminology, because it sounds like it wouldn't happen, but it really, really does. So we talk, and actually probably in some media outlets, we might be a bit sloppy about this, but asylum seeker, refugees, displaced persons. They all mean quite different things in terms of legal status, don't they? Can you just tell us why it matters?
Yeah, absolutely. So the term refugee outside of a legal context tends to mean somebody who is forced to leave their home country, either because of war, persecution, or because of a natural disaster. So we've got somebody that has to leave their home country. They may then choose to come to the UK. If somebody is in the UK, or they may be in the UK already, and then they can't go back to their home country for their reasons, they may then choose under our immigration laws to apply for asylum. They become an asylum seeker. It's really important to understand that, because usually an asylum seeker cannot work. It is possible that they can be given right to work in the UK, but that's normally if their application has been outstanding for 12 months or more. So somebody who's in the UK manages to get through border control without any form of permission, or is here already, applies for asylum. Once their application has been processed and if it's approved, they will be given refugee status, so legal refugee status. And at that point, they do have an open-ended right to work. So from an employer's perspective, and we'll come back to this again and again in this session this morning, it's about understanding, does the individual's legal status in the UK give right to work? And as such, is it possible for a business then to employ them? So Ukraine nationals do have the option to apply for asylum if they're here or if they're able to get here. But the government, of course, has put in additional routes for Ukraine nationals as a result of this crisis, which are alternatives, often better alternatives for Ukraine nationals.
OK, great. So we've got a sense of the different statuses that you might have at various points of the process. And there are now new routes, obviously, that have been created because of the crisis that sort of is apparent now. So if I'm an employer or a potential employer thinking, well, as we've done a lot over the last few weeks, the CBI, I've got a massive skills shortage. I need to fill these jobs. This is an opportunity for me. What are the things that, where are the schemes that I could go looking? What are the things that have been opened up that are new?
So let's start off by going through, and they're obviously very complex and details, but let's have a look at the different routes that are open to Ukraine nationals. This isn't something necessarily that UK businesses can help get. There are one option through the sponsorship routes, which I'll talk about. But there are, it's important to understand how individuals might come to the UK, or if they're here already, how they might stay in routes that give right to work. So we've got the family scheme and the Homes for Ukraine scheme. These are the two schemes that launched on the 18th of March, and are available for individuals who were resident in the Ukraine on the 1st of January of this year, before that date. The family scheme is the scheme that's relevant for individuals who have family members here in the UK. Again, quite detailed, but if we look at it, the person in the UK must either be a British national, somebody with settled or pre-settled status, or a refugee, or somebody with humanitarian leave. Then there must be the family connection with the Ukraine national. And you'll recall from the press that initially the definition of family members was quite narrow. But now it's a very, very wide definition. And I won't go through all the list, but it extends to cousins, parents-in-law, grandparents-in-law. So anybody that has a family connection with the UK, for them to go through the family route is probably the easiest route. Individuals without any existing family connections here, their appropriate route is the Homes for Ukraine. And that's the one, again, we're hearing a lot about it in the press. That's where individuals in the UK can be a sponsor for Ukraine nationals or whole families. They volunteer on the Home Office website. You can register your interest. You can be matched with somebody for whom you can be a sponsor. And then there's a joint application form for them to go through. Both the Homes for Ukraine and the family scheme allow full right to work and access to public funds in the UK. It will give them 36 months. There's a complex application process, but fundamentally they do give rights to work. There's a new one that's going to be launched on the 3rd of May, and that is the Ukraine Extension Scheme. So if anybody, any Ukraine nationals are already in the UK and had a valid visa, let's say it's a student visa, on the 18th of March, they will be able to extend that leave in the UK and be able to work again on an unfettered basis. So we've got the two that are applicable for people that were resident in the Ukraine on the 1st of January, and then the new one, which is going to be launched next month, for those that are in the UK and therefore weren't resident and aren't eligible under the other routes. Okay. And then apart from that, there's all the other routes that still exist, student routes, skilled worker routes, everything that would be applicable to everybody normally.
Thanks, Audrey. I know it feels a bit technical, but I think it is important we kind of build the picture. I can imagine people being tempted to think, well, okay, so here's my brilliant Ukrainian candidate, skill fits perfect for the job that I want. I'm just going to get going because, you know, I'm obviously doing the right thing. I'm just here to help. They can help me. I can help them. You know, I'll cut a few corners, but there are some really critical boxes that you need to tick in terms of key documents and eligibility criteria that under normal circumstances you would do, but you're sort of tempted to just kind of jump the gun. So let's just remind ourselves of what are the absolute essentials of the bits of paper you need to see.
So you're absolutely right. And I think it's tempting to be so taken by the complexity and the scenario and the situation that we've got that we forget the normal due diligence that all employers should go through when recruiting anybody. The Home Office gives us a route whereby we can check adequate right to work documents, and that will give all employers a protection against illegal working. There's a civil penalty of £20,000 if somebody employs somebody who doesn't have the legal right to work, but this going through the document checking process gives the protection against that. And all employers should do that for everybody, no difference. And in a way, that we should keep focused on that. And I know the schemes are complicated, but UK employers should focus on what they know and what they do best. If an individual has got permission through any of the schemes I've just mentioned, that will be evidenced in some format that employers check before employment commences. Right to work checks changed on the 6th of April of this year. They changed quite a lot, primarily in relation to checking biometric residence permits, which must be done online now. But there's a really helpful annex now in the Home Office's guidance. And Annex F sets out the detail around the different sorts of evidence that Ukraine nationals will have if they come to the UK through one of the routes I've just explained. So whether that will be a stamp in their passport, whether it will be a letter, and also the documents that UK employers check in order to satisfy this statutory excuse. So in a way, don't worry about the complexity of the schemes. The question for UK businesses, does this Ukraine national have the right to work? If it's yes, do our document checks. Everything will be fine.
Audrey, just a quick question come in from Karen Young. On the extension scheme you mentioned on the 3rd of May, say, for example, the student visa example you described, does that have the same 36-month entitlement like the other one? Are they all 36 months? Is that a standard?
I believe it does. But going back to what I said about right-to-work checks, when we do a right-to-work check, we check the documents and also we will be checking the end date. So let's say I get 12-month visa, we track the end date. So whatever end date is evidenced on a visa, we must then record that and track that in the same way as we would for anybody on a visa.
So let's say I've done a brilliant job of understanding all the schemes and I'm now an expert like you are in all the forms and the boxes and I know my right to work. And I say to myself, actually, I really, really want to do my bit here. I'm ready to go. I've got vacancies. I know the skills are available and the people need the work. Can I actively prefer? Can I set out to say, okay, these are jobs that are only for people who are Ukrainian refugees? Am I allowed to do that? And if so, how would I set that up?
And this is another example of going back to basics on our employment law. We go back to basics on our immigration with our right to work, and we go back to basics on our employment law. We know that the Equality Act protects people from being discriminated against on the grounds of their race. If I go to market with a vacancy, and I say, I would like to recruit a Ukrainian national into this role, I am then discriminated against anybody who isn't Ukrainian applying for that role on the grounds of their race. and using race or any other protected characteristic as a reason to employ somebody is race discrimination. And this will be direct race discrimination and is not justifiable. Although it sounds intuitively the right thing to do, it is a risk for a business to prefer somebody purely on the grounds of race. Obviously, there's other things you can do. You can seek ways in which to advertise your roles in places where there will be, and Chris will probably come to this, greater visibility of those roles to Ukraine nationals. But when the applications come in, you should assess everybody on their skills and abilities in the usual way and make a decision on that non-discriminatory basis.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Audrey. So there's a kind of, there's two messages here. One is there are new rules and facilities to sort of get your head around. The resources are there. Go and have a read. It takes a bit of getting your head around, but it's not impossible. You know, they're there to be used. They work. And then the other thing is a lot of this stuff we already know and we sort of do it by default. So don't forget all the things that we do anyway. I'm going to come to Chris in just a second. I want to draw everybody's attention to a brilliant post from Tony Goodger, who has plonked it in the chat via Alice. Thanks, Alice. About a thing that Tony represents, the Association of Independent Meat Suppliers, and they got in touch literally via Google with their equivalents in Ukraine and have a sort of established an ongoing communication with that, you know, the Ukrainian Bods, you know, Ukrainian Tony over there. And I think things like that are things that you can just do as an ordinary citizen and just sort of see who you can get in touch with. Google is a great thing. So thanks very much for that, Tony. It's a bit long for me to read out, but please do have a read of it. Krish Kandaya, thanks so much for being here. You're director of the Sanctuary Foundation. Just tell us what it is and what you do.
Thanks, Liz. So I've been working with refugees since the Kosovo crisis and most recently with refugees from Afghanistan and new arrivals in the UK from Hong Kong. But we set up Sanctuary Foundation because we realised I can't keep creating new organisations to cope with the next wave of immigration. So Sanctuary is an umbrella organisation that's trying to help UK individuals, churches, civil society groups and businesses play their part in welcoming refugees to the UK.
Okay, great. So this has been a busy time for you. I mean, I suppose, sadly, it's always a busy time for you, but this last few weeks in particular, tell us what you've been doing so far out of the Sanctuary Foundation to support humanitarian efforts in Ukraine.
So on the 1st of March, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, said that we would open something very unusual, an uncapped humanitarian sponsorship route. And uncapped's a big deal. That means that if we can find a sponsor, then a Ukrainian family can come to the UK. Normally we might have quotas or we might have some limits, but there was unlimited potential for the UK to show hospitality. But things went quiet for quite a long time. And I was a little bit nervous that we might not see this uncapped route actually become reality. So I tried to encourage people to volunteer for a program that didn't yet exist. And 11,000 people volunteered before the program was opened. And I think that helped as a bit of a catalyst for the government to know, look, there's a lot of people out here that want to do their part and want to welcome refugees. When the scheme did open on the 18th of March, as Audrey was mentioning, over 200,000 people have said they want to help. But at the moment, those two routes that Audrey mentioned are the only ones available, family reunification or the Homes for Ukraine scheme. And in order to be part of that, you need a home that you're able to welcome a Ukrainian family or individual to come and live in. Now, most people are not able to help in that way. Some people are, and it's absolutely fantastic, but most people aren't. I'm a foster parent. Because of the children that we look after, it's complicated for them to have new people come and live with us, even though we'd love to. And so the government's promised at some stage there's going to be kind of phase two, which businesses, community groups, civil societies and groups and churches might be able to be involved with. But at the moment, that isn't clear when and if that's going to happen. And so we're looking for other ways now that businesses and other groups might be able to help assist refugees.
Just before we move on to the other ways, because I think it's important for us to properly have a go at those other ways in this conversation. On Homes for Ukraine, funny enough, I had a meeting set up with a chap on Thursday and he cancelled at the last minute to say, oh, we've just had the call that our refugee who's been placed with us is arriving in the morning on Thursday. So I can't make the meeting. Is it working, that Homes for Ukraine scheme?
Overall, I want to say yes. There have been some frustrations, namely the speed of the visa applications has been slower than people would want. I'm always a kind of glass half full person. And what we're trying to do is turn around an oil tanker. At the moment, we're seeing maybe the UK government's approach to immigration in the Rwanda scheme. And we've kind of built a system where we're trying to, maybe you could say it this way, trying to keep out as many people as possible. And the Ukraine scheme is trying to welcome as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. So to see that change is quite difficult. It's an oil tanker kind of change. And I think as of the most recent statistics from the government, 3,200 arrivals have taken place through the Homes for Ukraine scheme. And again, that's nothing compared to the 4.1, 4.2 million people that have been displaced from Ukraine. But in the UK's immigration history, that is pretty astounding in the speed that we're talking about.
Thanks, Chris. So Audrey's done a brilliant job of trying to help us get going with all of the things that we need to be mindful of. If you're a business and you want to help, balancing off the opportunity with the be mindful of the risks and just, you know, don't go mad. How have businesses and employers been involved so far in the settlement process, if that's what it's the right word?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. So I've got six, I think, altogether. The first is on the jobs piece, and Audrey was really, really helpful. I would say this meat industry message that we've had is a really good one, because we're trying to match people's skills. You know, I've heard, you know, well, they can go and work in a shop, or they can go and work in a, you know, stacking shelves. If your job has been at a professional level and then you're then forced to go and work at a kind of more menial level, that's quite dehumanizing. And they've already experienced enough trauma in their lives to have to go and do that. So I love this idea of skills matching wherever possible. I think the other issue is that most of the people coming seem to be women with children, and both the women and the children are going to be experiencing trauma. So it might take them a while until they're ready into the workplace, but we want to be available and let them know that the jobs are here now, because some of the people in the refugee camps can't work out whether they want to come to the UK or not. If they come here, will they be able to find a job? So there's a little paradox there. We need to let them know jobs are here and we're willing to take them, but we don't want to rush people into it. It also probably means that the jobs that will be most attractive will be flexible. And thanks to lockdown, we're used to kind of flexible home working, people working in a kind of different hours, particularly as mums are going to need help settling their kids into school, helping their kids deal with the trauma. We've seen quite a few businesses come forward and offer some really innovative solutions. So we've been working with a business called Cook. They're the kind of premium pre-prepared food company.
They're
great, love it. I'm a big fan. I buy them whenever I can afford them. And they had a scheme called Raw Talent, which was a really clever play on words. And the idea is that they've been using that for other disadvantaged groups. So people that might have been homeless, people that might have been out of the workplace for a while, and it kind of gradually phases that them in. And they've made that offer available to Ukrainians as a kind of entry point into work. I'd love to pick Audrey's brains about how we do that in a way that doesn't discriminate, because I'm a huge fan of the Timpson company, which is targeting people that have come out of prison.
Absolutely.
So, you know, widening access to people that would otherwise not have made it into the job market. And I wonder if there's a sweet spot between not discriminating but widening that access at the same time.
We'll come on to the other part. I've just got one question on what you just said. I'm just remembering when you were talking about that, the skills matching. Okay, so even without the refugee conversation, we've had a number of conversations in the past few weeks about how hard it is to find people for the jobs. And it's so frustrating because you know that there's gazillions of people who could do it, but making those connections. Have you got any sort of brilliant tips, channels, routes? I've said before, I'm obsessed with recruitment. How do you find that person, given, you know, needle in a haystack, right?
No, it's a good point. And again, I've been working with the Hong Kong resettlement. We've seen over 100,000 people come to the UK from Hong Kong in the last year alone. And many of them highly skilled and keen to work as quickly as possible. So we've teamed up with a group called Naya. And again, they're trying to help people that often find it difficult, underrepresented groups. They call it hidden treasure, which I thought was a really or hidden talent, which is a great idea. So we did an event recently that was aimed at Hong Kongers that want to get into the IT industry here.
Yeah.
And so sometimes those specialized events just give people some of the cultural tools that they might need. I met one guy that had made 50 CV applications but hadn't had any responses. And I'm thinking, well, maybe there's a way in which the British expect CVs to be prepared that's different to the way it works in Hong Kong. maybe Hong Kong have been underselling themselves. So how can we help equip people to get the access to the jobs that they need? So those kind of specialist agencies might be a help here.
This is a half idea as well. I've just had a thought when you mentioned remote working. Obviously, remote working doesn't have to stop at the edges of where the sea is, around the edges of our island. If it's possible to work with somebody who's based in Wakefield and I'm in London, then it's surely possible to work with somebody who's based in Krakow or Warsaw or yes, you know, those countries where there's lots and lots of people who've been displaced too. So there must be ways to think through, although I do know that probably the rules about who is and isn't allowed to Audrey's point, are slightly different if you're based in a different country. Yeah.
Technically, it's possible. I met one Ukrainian refugee who worked for a company in Ukraine, and then when she moved here, she carried on working for the same company just remotely. So, you know, it was an international corporation. They were able to relocate her. They don't care where she lives as long as she's delivering the work.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in there. Absolutely, working remotely is becoming way more common, but there are lots of things employers need to think about. Sorry to be the bearer of the legal news, but you've got to think about the employment laws that apply to that individual, and whether or not you're complying with Polish maternity leave, for example. But probably the biggest issue is tax. How do you account for tax and social security to the individual? And does having employees in a jurisdiction create a permanent establishment for corporation tax? So it's absolutely something to think about, but you do need to go through, and particularly with your finance teams, to make sure you're not creating a financial risk with that cross-border remote working model.
Chris, you've got five more things that people who are running businesses can do. We've obviously talked a lot about employment, but it doesn't just stop at giving somebody a job, does it? There's lots of other ways that businesses can
help. Right. We had over 530 businesses sign up on the Sanctuary Foundation just to say, look, we're here, we want to make an offer. Making an offer really helps government to know that you're there. I know many companies have connected with government directly. The advantage of someone like me is that I can be a voice and keep reminding government, look, we've got 500, 600, 1,000 businesses, come and make use of that offer. So one of them that I came across that was really good is, because this phase two isn't possible, the only way we can really help refugees is by supporting those people that are already sponsoring. So think about the Homes for Ukraine scheme and thinking, what is it that I as a business can do to get around that? NatWest, the High Street Bank, they offer anyone that sponsors two additional days of volunteering time. So that's paid leave in order to do that. I think that's a lovely gesture, isn't it? It doesn't cost the company too much. Someone feels a little bit more secure that the time I'm giving is going to be kind of counted back again. And it's a great internal incentive, isn't it? You just tell that story. Look, we as a company are behind sponsoring. So therefore, we're going to support anyone that does that with two additional days. I thought that was a lovely idea. There might be other things that you could do as an employer to tell the good news stories of what your employees are doing and just get behind them and cheer them on. Second area is accommodation. As soon as a refugee arrives in the UK through the Homes for Ukraine scheme, they should be eligible to housing benefit. But as you may know, social housing is a real challenge right now in the UK. It's one of the reasons there are 11,500 Afghan refugees still in hotels, costing the government £4.7 million a day to keep them there. And they don't want to be there. They want to be in homes to try and start rebuilding their lives. So accommodation is a really key thing. And that might be something that your business is involved in. I was speaking with a student accommodation provider called Scape. And we're looking at whether we can get something going in Guildford, where as soon as someone arrives through a sponsor family, we try to help them into independent accommodation through a scheme working with Scape and the local authority. And if we can get that over the line, it might be another way that the sponsor is like a lily pad. They arrive in the country, they've got some friendly support, and then we help them get out and have a door that they can lock, and they can just shields down, be the family they need to be, don't have to keep doing everything in English, just, you know, just be themselves and have some agency, have some decision making about when they eat, what they eat, when they go out, what they wear. All of that really helps someone recover from trauma. So accommodation is really key. The third thing is supporting sponsors through setting up kind of community networks. Punch pubs have been great at that. Our local church has done that. Other, like Cafe Nero, have been involved in that. They just offered somewhere that community could come and start to meet each other. So a regular meeting for the sponsors, for the Ukrainians that have just arrived in your area, just another space where people can be. I remember when we had the Syrian crisis, Starbucks stepped up and they said, look, there's been a lot of debate about whether we want refugees here or not. Why don't we change the conversation by inviting you to have coffee with a refugee? So we set up these meetings at Starbucks up around the country. And if you've never met a refugee before, have a coffee with one, share a tea with one. Suddenly they're not a refugee, they're a person that you need to connect with. Are there other ways that your business can provide those kind of safe meeting spaces for people to connect?
That's a brilliant idea, Christian. Not something that I would have thought of. If I'm listening to this thinking, oh, my business has premises where there could be coffee, there could be chats, who do I ring to say, I think I can facilitate a community, and maybe I am only in one city, or maybe yeah. I'm all over the place. I'm just thinking, you know, I'm sitting here in one of those shared workspaces, you know, where it sure. looks like a coffee shop from the outside, but actually it's, but we could do that in theory. How do I do it? Who do I ring?
Drop me a line. I think my email or my website will come up. I'm keen to help. We're a startup company, a startup charity. We formed Charity Formation in 2 weeks, which may be, as far as I know, a record in my world. But we're keen to see those. I think these stories of goodwill begin yes. to change people's mindset. Okay. And I think that's really important. At the moment, the whole nation is supportive of Ukraine, and we want to carry on encouraging them to be that way. So these little stories of really positive things that people are doing really help. Yeah. The fourth one is donating funds and goods. So here's another one, Punch Pubs. I don't know why. This pub chain have been amazing.
Pub-based activities I'm always very pro. Let's hear another pub one.
Other pubs are available. they found out that they had a whole stash of Ukrainian beer, right? And they've decided to make it available to their publicans at cost and then donate the extra money to us, which was just amazing. And again, it's symbolic, isn't it? You know, Ukrainians, they've got a great hospitality industry. Let's cheer it on. But let's raise some money at the same time. Another need we've found out is that because these mums are coming, I've met them at the border in Moldova as they just came in off from Ukraine. And a lot of them are carrying very little, like two suitcases, and most of the suitcases are full of stuff for their kids. Yeah. So there are some basics that people need in order to start life again. We found that with Afghan refugees too. So we're partnering with an organization called Baby Basics. There are 50 baby banks around the country. They've been supporting vulnerable women in their communities for many years, and they've just extended that to Ukrainians. One massive need that we found are things like new car seats, pushchairs, all of that kind of stuff. There are all sorts of laws and rules about using donating secondhand goods. Most charity shops don't receive secondhand goods when it involves children, so we need new stuff. And at the moment, we're buying retail, like we're going into Asda and just buying everything they've got, which is really inefficient. But those are really kind of game-changing things for families as they begin to start their lives up again. And they can't bring them themselves, and it's complicated doing secondhand. So goods are another ways that people can help with that. Number five is around services, and those services might be for sponsors or they might be for refugees, but both are useful. So I had an offer from Seismic, which is a big tech company. They do amazing HR onboarding. So Deliveroo don't meet all their staff. They just send them through a 6-episode, you know, onboarding training program. So we've created a training resource for anyone who's a volunteer or a sponsor. No training has been given to any of the sponsors, all the volunteers so far. And we're dealing with loads of people with trauma. We're dealing with children, and therefore there's safeguarding issues, and no one's been given any training. So Seismic and Lessonly is their platform, have said, look, we've got this platform. Why don't we just make it available to you for free? And that helps me scale up the kind of support that we can give. So there might be other IT solutions that you might have. I know Vodafone, for example, they've been giving free SIM cards to all the refugees that arrive, because data is absolutely key if you want to stay in touch with your family. So you might just be thinking to yourself, what is it that I've got that could really benefit a refugee family feeling like they belong here? The other one is services towards sponsors. So again, NatWest, they just wrote to people saying, look, this will not affect your house insurance and it won't affect your mortgage if you take a refugee into your family. Now, again, some of you are providing services that sponsors are using, and they don't know that. You know, just being proactive and telling them it's okay, we've got your back, releases people to come and actually make a difference. So that, I thought that was a lovely little gesture. Yeah. Again, costs you nothing as a company, but it says we're here and we'll do whatever we can to make it possible for you to welcome refugees. So I'll give you the six again. Supporting sponsors, do what you can. 2 days of leave that NatWest give. Offering accommodation, that's number two. Supporting communities, could you make a space available? Are there goodies that you could give to communities? Like here's some stuff you could put into a goodie bag as people arrive. You could take the initiative with that. Number four, donating funds or goods. Number five, services to support sponsors or refugees. Number six is the whole jobs piece. But I just want to say, after what Matthew shared, this has been a really tough time for businesses up and down the country, yeah, with lockdown and COVID. But I've been so impressed that businesses are still saying, we want to do more than just think about our bottom line. We want to help refugees, and it won't be forgotten. People will remember this for the rest of their lives, that you were there when they needed your help. And so I just want to encourage you, keep going, keep doing the amazing stuff that you're doing, and thank you.
That's absolutely brilliant, Christian. Tons of thoughts that I would never have come up with myself. And I'm also thinking of other people who I'm like, oh, those people could do that thing. Mm-hmm. So really, really, really useful. I want to make sure, just in our last couple of minutes, that I draw people's attention if they've not spied them, and give a couple of shout outs. Tom Hadley has mentioned the Recruitment and Employment Confederation, REC, who are doing loads of good work trying to get off on the front foot on that skills matching piece. So check out their website. And then Tony Goodger again has posted a link to ukrainiansintheuk.info, which is a useful place to sort of see, you know, various different starting points if you're thinking, oh, I've got an idea, where do I go next? And then a book recommendation as well, The Lightless Sky by Gulwali Parsali, who is, I probably pronounced that really badly, but
you got it right. I know him.
A story of what refugees go through. It just helps to sort of connect with people on a human level. Matthew, we've had probably the busiest 45 minutes that we've had for a long time. So I'm going to just go and have a lie down in a darkened dream, but just some closing thoughts from you from a CBI perspective. I want to say a big thank you to everybody for joining, and obviously to Audrey and Chris for their brilliant insight and expertise. Matthew, what have you made of today? What are you going to do now?
Yeah, look, very rich conversation, Liz. Brilliant, and lots of tips for people. I think in terms of what happens next and what do we do? One is, I was just struck by just how much of this plays into some of the debates we've been having about the near-term challenges facing business. You know, you think about the issues that people are talking about, inflation, labour shortages, energy costs. So all of those near-term challenges, I think there's plenty that we've got on the go from the CBI point of view to be offering businesses, not necessarily solutions and magic wands to make all of that go away, but practical, how do you manage and live through some of those kind of issues? And that obviously docks in with a lot of what we've been talking about today. So keep an eye out for that coming to you. Speak to your CBI account managers about what we've got to help you navigate some of that. And then really back to the heart of the conversation today, just building and picking up all the sort of tips that Audrey and Chris have given us. I think the reminder is, look, there's so much good intent out there. Don't feel like, you know, just because you can't do one of these things, other offers of help are not useful. We've seen a big array of different things that companies can be doing. So please do get in touch with us. We'll put details in the chat. There's plenty of links in the chat. Chris and Audrey have shared their details. Do come to the CBI as well. If you want to sort of put forward, we think we can help in this way, whether it be through employment or provision of goods such as food, clothing, medical supplies, some of the services that Chris has talked about, logistics or comms or whatever it might happen to be, come forward to the CBI. We've got a brilliant network. We're working not just with CBI members, but with loads of other sort of stakeholders and organisations who are expert in this field, as we've heard from today. And we can do our very best to connect you up and turn that sort of good intent into practical action and activity. So Liz, that's the sort of closing thought from me. Come forward and let us know how you want to help, and we'll do our best to connect you up.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Matthew. And a big thank you to, of course, to Audrey Elliott and to Krish Kandaya for their insight this for this session. That's our time. As I always say, whether you're watching or listening, wherever you are, go put the kettle on before you dive back into your emails and have a great rest of the day. Thanks so much. All the best. Bye.